The Cambridge Plan. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Revelation of John. One day during the writing of Science and Health, Mrs. Glover had received a letter from Wallace W. Wright. He was still confused by malicious mesmerism, as is evident from its contents. "It is evident to me that you desire Dr. Kennedy to leave the city, and I think also it would be for your interest to accomplish this end. The relations between he and I are probably of a different nature from what you suppose, as I owe him a debt on the past, which, if driving him from Lynn will accomplish, it can and shall be done. He thinks that I am your greatest enemy, and favors, if either, his side. Let him continue to think so. It will do me no harm. For my part, I rather a person would come out boldly and fearlessly, as you and I did, facing each other, than to sneak like a snake in the grass, spitting his poison venom into them he would slay. I have said I owe Dr. Kennedy on an old score, and the interview I had with him last evening has increased that debt, so that I am now determined, if it be your object also, as two heads are better than one, to drive him from Lynn. Why should we be enemies, especially if we have one great object in common? Perhaps we can be united on this, and the result may be that this city will finally be rid of one of the greatest humbugs that ever disgraced her fair face. All this can be accomplished, but as I said before, it is necessary to be very cautious, and not let the fact of our communicating together be known, as a friend in the enemy's camp, is an advantage not to be overlooked. In reply, Mrs. Glover said, "We will help you always to do right. But with regard to your proposition to send Dr. Kennedy out of Lynn, we recommend that you leave this to God. His sins will find him out. Even though so falsely accused, we shall never swerve from the right. If defrauded and set at naught, God will one day justify his children. You said Dr. Kennedy denied his indebtedness to us. We can show you, under his own signature, his agreement with us that he has broken, and a note he has never paid of $750. Richard Kennedy had not forgotten that he had paid only $250 on his $1,000 note, and the dark plot he built around this obligation is well nigh inconceivable. But Mrs. Glover's thought, since the dissolution of their partnership, had been constantly on her book. The suggestion of driving Richard Kennedy or anyone else from the city, she did not entertain for one second. However, she did at times long to escape from the constant harassment of her dissolute students. Now that her manuscript was in the hands of the printer, she could entertain thoughts of a new beginning in another city. After much deliberation, she settled upon Cambridge, Massachusetts, as a promising location for the planting of her standard. She needed a demonstrator, a loyal student, to accompany her. Her time must be given to planting the standard, and she must have one practicing student to whom she could refer patients and new students for help and consultation. George Barry was very busy on the book business, and few were qualified. The mantle fell upon Samuel Putnam Bancroft and was a very serious step in that young man's life. He wrote in his diary on the 7th of December, "Today I take another step, and one which I take with fear and trembling, but in which I feel that I am obeying the call of wisdom, which call I dare not disobey. I have today come before the world as a demonstrator of the science of healing the sick by the power of soul over matter, as taught by Mary M. B. Glover, and which I believe to be the true science of man." Bancroft opened his office in Cambridge in December. The plan was that George Barry would move there with Mrs. Glover as soon as a suitable tenement could be located. And once the venture was established, Bancroft would bring his wife to Cambridge. Mrs. Glover selected the wording for Putney's business card, which read, "S. P. Bancroft, Scientific Physician, Gives No Medicine." Bancroft, George Barry, and Mr. Hitchings, a real estate agent, were all engaged in finding the right place for Mary Glover's next move. But George was also much in Boston on the book business, which took precedence. It was not the business of Mrs. Glover and her students, however, that foiled all their efforts in Cambridge, including her plans to visit and lecture there prior to moving. An entry in Samuel Bancroft's diary on the 11th of January in 1875 described the unexpected events of one day that occupied the time of everyone concerned. "I received a letter today from George Barry, giving me an account of a strange experience which my teacher passed through on Friday last, and which he was present to witness. It seems he called on her with Mr. Hitchings, and on rapping, heard a voice, hardly above a whisper, say, 'Come in.' On entering, she arose to meet them, but fell back, lost consciousness, and to their belief was gathering herself on the other side. George went after Mrs. Rice, who came, and immediately a change took place. George had called on her mentally to come back, but Mrs. Rice called loudly, as for someone afar off, and the answer came, faintly at first, but stronger and stronger, till she was able to sit up and have the Bible and manuscripts read to her, and finally recovered. Mary still did not know that all of the malicious attacks against her were traceable to Kennedy's work. But circumstances and events, plus her own spiritual vision, gradually revealed to her the character and method of evil. Later in the month, she wrote the following letter to Samuel Putnam Bancroft. "Lynn, January 22nd. Dear student, I am sad at your want of practice, but think the one principal reason I have discovered. I know it is not in you that your moral claims are sufficient for success, but I have seen in spiritual vision the enemy at work, and today I learned from Mr. Prescott the whole case. Kennedy is hounding your footsteps. He has been going to Cambridge Port for weeks past, constantly, on the pretense that he has patients there. But I know he never visits patients in that way. Where your circulars have gone, he has got hold of the minds and turned them away from their purpose to give you a call. Now I have tried to have Prescott help you, and he is interested for you, but Dick's magnetism of mind reaches him, and just as he concludes to study, he will hear something that turns him away. The fact is, he is the most impressible person to mental influence I about ever saw. And because I have no power to do wrong as Dick has, we are not equally matched. And so it is with my good students. He injured Ingalls, so that Ingalls injured himself to meet him. I am almost tired to death of so much effort made against me, and nothing on the right side to weigh in the scale of truth for me and the cause. Now go about your own way, dear student, but do not stand still. Make a stir. Go to the sick and heal them if they do not send for you. Be meek, but dignified in your acts and work. That is all my resort, and I know no other for you. Lovingly, your teacher, M.B.G. In 1875, Mrs. Glover knew not the depths of the evil to which Kennedy had lent his thought, nor the subtle maliciousness to which Prescott was exposed. For Kennedy was living in Prescott's house. Nor did she know at this point how to combat the intentional wickedness of evil minds. She did not know that you cannot fight evil with evil, so her only resort was to keep working for good. But Infinite Mind had uncovered the evil and shown her its workings, and mind would in time reveal to her how to meet it. Almost every day she could see Dick's influence, even on her loyal students, confusing and nullifying them. Before the end of the month, she was to see his malicious endeavor discourage and nullify her prize student, Samuel Bancroft. Bancroft never did see the issue of malicious animal magnetism clearly, but he was much affected by it, nonetheless. By the end of January, he had given up the Cambridge venture in despair and written Mrs. Glover a letter expressing regret at being one more student to disappoint her. A portion of her response read, "Dear One More, you refer to the injury your failure will be to me and the cause. I am more sensible of that than you are. My students have done me irreparable injury, while I have been doing all in my power under the circumstances for them. When I suffer for truth, they desert me, and when I send out their names, endorsed by myself, they disgrace my recommendation by a failure or turning into mesmerism and working against me. Why is all this? They love more the ties of the flesh than those of the spirit, and always hold on to the former if they conflict with the latter. I am not censuring anyone. I am only explaining for your good what hinders your success, as you do to the sick what stands in the way of their recovery. You know better than they. I know better than you. And yet your spiritual perception of the way is far beyond some others. Not curing and keeping until cured your first patients was where you lost. Do not let it be thought you left because you were driven out. Call it your family, as it was in reality. Had you not laid up first your treasures in earthly things, you would have been free to work on under difficulties, but you chose not to take the footsteps of science. And because you are better than Kennedy, you have no prosperity in wrong. I could not help you when I desire to more than I ever did, or I should have done more than I have. In love, M.B.G. Christian Science emerges. Mrs. Glover was living in Lynn, in the boarding house of Amos Scribner's on Broad Street, when the Cambridge plan collapsed. She had hoped to plant her standard in a more favorable location, but in reality, her standard had already been planted. The establishment of moral science, the teaching and successful practice in healing the sick, and then the perversion of her teaching for wicked purposes were all part of its history. The divine reality of science in its purity had unfolded in Mary's consciousness, and experience was teaching her what mortal man would do with this priceless gift. She had learned that only the Christian thought could be trusted with the omnipotence of divine science. Thus it was in 1875 that Christian Science emerged from her founding footsteps as the savior of the world. For many months, Mrs. Glover had been considering the establishment of a home for students, as well as for herself, which would become a center of scientific activity. As she looked out her window one day, she saw that a sign had recently been placed on a house across the street, which read, "For sale." It seemed providential. Arrangements were made for the purchase, and very soon thereafter, Mary moved, not to Cambridge, but across the street. Mrs. Spofford, who had recently returned to Lynn, had seemed strangely estranged from her teacher, and it was rumored that the Spoffords were estranged from one another and had separated. Daniel Spofford was also in Lynn, endeavoring to practice metaphysical healing from what he had gleaned from his wife's manuscripts. In February, Mrs. Glover had kindly sent him an invitation to attend her next class, free of charge. The purchase of the house had depleted Mary's funds, and there were still mortgage payments to meet, so it was necessary to rent out her rooms to meet expenses. She kept only a small attic room for herself, and the second floor front parlor for a classroom. There, a class of four, including Daniel Spofford, met in April. In the classroom, Daniel Harrison Spofford justified Mrs. Glover's hopes. He was a sincere, dedicated, intelligent young man, desirous of pursuing the path of righteousness, as this letter he wrote to his teacher on the 26th of April, during the course of instruction, indicates. Many, many times each day I ask myself, do we students realize what is held out for our possession? Do we realize that we are moving to a position which, while here, if we are faithful, brings us from the world probably nothing but trials and rebuffs, but that in ages to come, these meetings in the upper chamber will have passed into history, and that we will be blessed or cursed according to our fidelity in the preserving of truth, until time shall be at an end. Oh, that I might be worthy, that I might have lived the life of righteousness to enable me to give to you be it ever so little, of that living water which you must so desire to drink." Mrs. Glover's teaching was in consonance with her forthcoming book. The terminology Science of Man and Moral Science had largely given place to Christian Science, the term she employed to express the spiritual science of mind healing. Mary had learned that another book, titled Science of Life, was already in print, so a new title for her volume was essential, but it was not immediately forthcoming. When it did come, she was certain of its rightness and copyrighted the new title on the 2nd of June. Of this new name she wrote, "6 weeks I waited on God to suggest a name for the book that I had been writing. Its title, Science and Health, came to me in the silence of night, when the steadfast stars watched over the world, when slumber had fled, and I rose and recorded the hallowed suggestion. The following day I showed it to my literary friends, who advised me to drop both the book and the title. To this, however, I gave no heed, feeling sure that God had led me to write that book and had whispered that name to my waiting hope and prayer. It was to me the still small voice that came to Elijah after the earthquake and the fire." Mrs. Glover was constantly sharing her inspiration openly and freely with those around her, while the serpent was just as constantly working in secret to thwart her every move. Mary had a vision regarding her book at this time, which she did not fully understand until later. But she told a class in 1888 that that vision was just as visible to sense as they were. She saw a beautiful maiden, clad in pure white, standing at the altar, being wedded to a terrible, sensuous man. She cast herself down, weeping, and implored that it should not be, but she was forced back. She recognized this man when he entered her experience some 3 years later, but she did not know until long afterward that he was an accomplice of the mesmerist. Daniel Spofford opened an office in Lynn as soon as his course of instruction was completed, and was outstandingly successful from the outset. At last, Mrs. Glover had a capable, practicing student, devoting all his time to the cause, although he was not unlike all the other students in turning to his teacher for help with difficult cases. For example, the woman with whom Spofford boarded also had her small granddaughter, Ethel, living with her. One day, Ethel fell down a deep stairwell at school and was gravely injured. When the child was brought home in an unconscious condition, Spofford offered to heal her, and to the relief of the alarmed grandmother, he did so in a very short time. Ethel then thought it would be smart to return to school, but the alarm at her appearance was so great that it affected the child as seriously as had the fall, so that she was taken home unconscious a second time. This time, Daniel Spofford's work seemed to be ineffective, and he went immediately to Mrs. Glover for help. At the moment his teacher was apprised of the situation, the child was instantaneously healed, and her healing was complete and permanent. 30 years later, Ethel West became a student of Christian Science. But at the time, despite her healing, the family was strongly prejudiced against Mrs. Glover because of the lies and malicious rumors gossiped and spread about Lynn. Mary kept on with her work, letting future ages speak for her accomplishments. But her loyal students were endeavoring to counteract the misconceptions and extend her teachings. On the 1st of June, 8 students drew up and signed the following resolutions. Whereas in times not long past, the science of healing, new to the age and far in advance of all other modes, was introduced into the city of Lynn by its discoverer, a certain lady, Mary Baker Glover. And whereas many friends spread the good tidings throughout the place and bore aloft the standard of life and truth, which had declared freedom to many manacled with the bonds of disease or error, and whereas by the willful and wicked disobedience of an individual who has no name in love, wisdom, or truth, the light was obscured by clouds of misinterpretation and mists of mystery, so that God's work was hidden from the world and derided in the streets. Now, therefore, we students and advocates of this moral science, called the science of life, have arranged with the said Mary Baker Glover to preach to us or direct our meetings on the Sabbath of each week, and hereby covenant with one another, and by these presents do publish and proclaim that we have agreed and do each and all agree to pay weekly for 1 year, beginning with the 6th day of June, A.D. 1875, to a treasurer chosen by at least 7 students, the amount set opposite our names, provided nevertheless the monies paid by us shall be expended for no other purpose or purposes than the maintenance of said Mary Baker Glover as teacher or instructor, than the renting of a suitable hall and other necessary incidental expenses, and our signatures shall be a full and sufficient guarantee of our faithful performance of this contract. Signed, Elizabeth M. Newell, $1.50. Daniel H. Spofford, $2. George H. Allen, $2. Dorcas B. Rawson, $1. Asa T. N. McDonald, 50 cents. George W. Berry, $2. S. P. Bancroft, 50 cents. Miranda R. Rice, 50 cents. Before the end of the month, these students had adopted Mrs. Glover's advancing terminology and agreed to call themselves Christian Scientists. The printer had had the manuscript for months and months. $700 had been paid in advance, and still the book was not out. Finally, Mrs. Glover yielded to the growing conviction that she must include in the last chapter some of what she had learned about malpractice, even though she was still working daily for Richard Kennedy, hoping that his eyes might be opened so that he would forsake mesmerism and turn again to the truth. After fulfilling her painful task of composing a partial history of mental malpractice, she loaned the manuscript to Prescott, possibly hoping that if Dick saw the exposé, it might cause reform. She had gone clear to the bottom of the sea of iniquity in her vision of 1872, but she was far from the bottom in dealing with it in her human experience. The manuscript was stolen from Prescott's house. Kennedy was probably responsible, and most likely Prescott challenged him. In the following account, Mrs. Eddy did not name Prescott, but it is most probable that this is the history of Kennedy's revenge on that student. He ruined a promising student who was somewhat addicted to intemperance before he learned metaphysics, but when he left our class, was thoroughly reformed and labored in turn to help others abandon their cups. He had totally abstained from strong drinks and lost his appetite for them when Kennedy went to board with him. Shortly afterward, they had a slight altercation about their teacher, in which the mesmerist was shown up in no favorable light. Subsequently, the reformed student called on us, appeared dejected and not as courageous regarding himself as usual. We questioned him, and he replied, "I have at times an impetuous desire to drink liquor. I cannot account for this, for I detest it and have no relish for it. Still, this strange feeling that I must get intoxicated comes over me at stated periods with an overwhelming force. Being ignorant at that time of the cause of all this, we suggested it might be the chemicalization by which chronic errors sometimes pass off." He replied, "I have treated it for that metaphysically, but without success." A sudden interruption closed our conversation, and we saw him no more. But in 3 months from that time, we learned that he was a demoralized man and a confirmed sot. He never was that before. Had Mary known what she later learned about this student's experience, she might have used stronger language in the manuscript she prepared for the printer. Nevertheless, her exposure of animal magnetism completed the volume, and the book now went forward. The Sunday meetings held in pursuance of the student's resolutions were very well attended. But because the dissidents were endeavoring to take advantage of public meetings, Mrs. Glover saw fit to discontinue them after 5 weeks. Nonetheless, the summer of 1875 was a period of rich fulfillment. In Samuel Bancroft's words, "I consider the summer of 1875 the most harmonious period of the 12 years from 1870 to 1882, during which Mrs. Eddy had continued to reside in Lynn. I never knew her so continuously happy in her work. Although she was writing, teaching, and preaching, and occasionally treating some severe case beyond a student's ability to reach, her physical and mental vigor seemed to be augmented rather than depleted. I can picture her now as she stood, erect and stately, on the raised platform of the little hall on Market Street, unwearied and undismayed, while curious questioners strove to confound her, on such occasions we were very proud of our teacher. The Revelator had seen in prophetic vision the woman of the apocalypse, and she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. The 9 long pregnant years of the woman's travail were coming to an end, and the pain of the labor was behind her. The earth had prepared a place for the woman in the founding of the United States of America, and now the woman had prepared a place for her child. She had developed a family of loyal Christian Scientists who would welcome, love, and cherish her offspring that God had named Science and Health, and she had provided a home for her child and family. The home now had a sign over the door with an open Bible, a cross and crown, and the words, "Mary B. Glover's Christian Scientists' Home."